equitable and administratively feasible. That's the kind of thing that I guess I'm suggesting you move toward.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions for Larry? More preparation for the next answer. If you do have some questions, of course, you get them to Nancy. She can get them directed back to Larry for answering at the next meeting on February 29th. Any other comments for Larry? Okay, Larry, thanks a lot for calling in. I think we've made, seems to me we're making some type of progress and beginning to get things
okay.
Focused a little bit. We appreciate your help.
Okay, and your brothers, that I give you a call tomorrow?
Yes, we're scheduled to start at 10 o'clock in the morning our time, 2 o'clock your time. We're going to begin with Dr. Wilson giving an overview on malpractice, and then we thought it would be appropriate for you to come in and discuss with us what has worked in other states or has not worked, what other states are doing, and then we'll continue on with our discussion from there.
Mr. Chairman, if we don't start promptly at 10, I think it'd be better that please call at 10:45. Now, are we going to start promptly at 10?
Okay, or we can call you. Are you going to be? No, we can't call you. You can call us. 10:45. How about 10:45?
10:45.
Or even 11.
10:45.
Good. I'll call you then.
Okay, and you'll have all the answers for tort reform and malpractice.
It may be a short phone call, Jim.
Oh, we hope not. Okay. Anyone else with any questions? Okay, thanks, Larry.
Okay, speak to you tomorrow. Good luck, folks.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Right, let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and do CON and try to wrap up the fight. Here is listed 5 additional suggestions for strengthening the certificate of need process through the incorporation of more stringent standards for the CON process. And let me just go through them real quickly. The first and most important, I suppose, is to legislation direct the Department of Health and Social Services to promulgate in regulation standards based on need and cost for determining whether a CON should be awarded. Now, under the current CON laws, I understand, and Larry may want to comment on this, the criterion for the determination of award is based upon federal law and the guidelines guiding the decision come from the State Health Plan, which was last revised in 1984, and of course that health plan is somewhat out of date. And in addition, in the health plan there are guidelines, but as far as I can tell, there weren't any standards. And the guidelines themselves can be
that standard implies an occupancy rate, and that in turn implies how much the state is willing to pay for excess capacity, traded off against possibility of a facility being overcrowded so that they have to turn somebody away. That's where the policy decision lies in that standard, and somebody needs to step up and say, we've decided this is what the policy is. Third, the legislation, I think, needs to provide the resources to develop the standards. A number of states have very detailed standards running to 30 to 40 pages. And I think that these could serve as a starting point for Alaskan standards. But they need to be modified to take into account the small size of Alaskan communities and the transportation network in the state. And this, I think, would be the primary work involved in adopting standards that work in other places, California, Missouri, and so on and so forth, to the Alaskan environment. Because when you look at these standards for other states, the only place that they really could reasonably apply would be a location like Anchorage, which actually has a semblance of a health market, some competition you find in other states. The fourth thing would be to require the department to collect cost, use, and patient origin data for facilities on an annual basis. They need, if the CON process is going to work, the people making the decisions have to have a database of information about what demand is for facilities and procedures and what costs are, because they're going to be looking not only at the application itself, but how that application impacts the rest of the healthcare system, how that impacts demand on other facilities, how that impacts the cost of other facilities, and consequently how it impacts the entire healthcare system, not just the proposer. And fifth, there has to be an ongoing process for analyzing this information. Right now, the guidelines that we have are based on 1984, and we're finding based on changing technology and so on. If those guidelines were appropriate in 1984, it's unlikely that they're still appropriate. So those are some of the, I think, the main things that would be necessary to strengthen the proposed changes to the CON process to make it work better in terms of imposing those standards on the process. Maybe I should halt there and turn it over to Larry.
Pass out the handout, Nancy. I've got a handout here that Nancy's going to pass out, and basically we threw together some work real quick on whether other states are doing in area standards, and so I'll kind of talk for a few minutes about what states are doing that in that area. I'm glad to see that the task force is interested in standards for health facilities. It's a very needed concept in Alaska, and it's used in many other states, but it's accomplished mainly through the Certificate of Need program in other states. And then health facilities are required to meet these minimum standards before states will approve a Certificate of Need. All the health facilities know what the standards are and know they have to meet them. Alaska does not have standards like this in our Certificate of Need program. So how do other states use standards for reviewing health facility projects? We only had a short time, but we did look at 12 different states. If you look at your handout here, you'll see that we looked at 12 different states, and we've got a little chart here on table one. We found basically that states established standards in three ways in statute. The commissioner is given the power, the state health planning agency is given the power, or it's done by virtue of the state health plan, or even some states have a comprehensive health planning act. The most common way it's done is to give the power to the state health planning agencies. And I'll just kind of tell you a little bit about how some of the different states do it. Of the 12 states reviewed, Delaware, Missouri, North Carolina, and Washington were probably the clearest in giving the state health planning agency the power to establish standards. Illinois and Washington list the standards right in their regulation. Other states publish standards in their health plan, as Scott talked about. What kind of methodology do these use? Most states use, as Scott touched on, a population projected or a population-based methodology. The bed need and formula may include needs per 1,000 population or patient days per population, that sort of thing. Many states also use a standard occupancy rate. They generally require facilities to be in the 75 or even 85% range for acute care facilities. Montana, on the other hand, which some people think is similar to Alaska, has the lowest occupancy rate standards. For acute care, it's 80% for facilities with 90 beds, 60% for facilities with 30 to 84 beds, and 40% for facilities with less than 30 beds. And while North Carolina has occupancy standards for acute care at 70% for facilities with 1 to 49 beds, and it increases to 85% for larger facilities up to 400 beds. So some states use a sliding scale there for their standards. From what we found, no state uses a turnaway rate like the one Scott kind of described. However, that doesn't mean it's appropriate for Alaska, and it might even be a very appropriate way for Alaska considering our peak seasonal demands and that sort of thing. We found that there was some variation in the services that standards for CON view among the various states. Most states have a variety of standards, including long-term care, acute care, psychiatric beds, medical technology, and on and on. Almost all states have strict controls or standards on long-term care and nursing beds, and many of them even have moratoriums on long-term care or nursing beds. As I said earlier, most states have statutory authorities to set standards. If you look in your handout, if you look on the third page, I've just got some kind of suggested language or examples of language of what various states do. North Carolina, I drew a box around it from the bottom of the page, and there's a little star. But they basically say develop policy criteria and standards for health service facilities planning, conduct statewide inventories of, and make determination of need for health service facilities and develop a state health plan. And then the next page, Delaware, I drew a box around that. It's got a little star by it. It's on the top. Delaware has says develop specific criteria and other guidance for use in reviewing certificate of need applications. And then the next page, I included some examples from Missouri's criterion standards, and I think they have a good example. And as Scott said, they've got some of these states have many, many pages. But if you turn to the next page, the table of contents for Missouri's criterion standards, you'll see all the different categories. It ranges from long-term care, cardiovascular, MRIs, new emergent technology, which I think is appropriate, pediatric beds, psychiatric beds, acute care, big list there. And then I've got a couple examples in here of the different standards. Turn to the next page, you'll see the long-term care review guidelines. And it's interesting to note, if you look down in the middle of the page under D, number 3, it just says a facility seeking approval to expand its bed capacity must have maintained an occupancy rate of at least 90% for at least the previous year. And then right below that, number 4, modernization or replacement projects will not be approved unless the resulting bed capacity is established at a level which will allow for at least a 90% occupancy rate. So that's a very strict standard. Next page, MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging. And they're basically, they require 2,000 MRI procedures a year before they will approve an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. And then finally, we have acute care bed methodology here. It's really interesting, when I was talking to the guy in Missouri, he said that they were thinking about dropping their acute bed methodology because they're not having anybody build new hospitals. In fact, the problem is a lot of the hospitals in smaller areas are going out of business. So just kind of an interesting thing. But anyway, they have a formula here, and it's a population-based methodology. So anyway, Missouri is kind of a good example of what various states do. So that's kind of an overview of what the other states are doing. They tie their standards in with a certificate of need, And they usually have a policy-making body that really passes judgment on these. And so I think that's kind of a good process. So, and as Scott said, right now we don't have this in our certificate of need program. We really don't have the data, and we really don't have standards. We have to do, when we do a project, we do the best job we can, but the more information we have, the better. If we had standards, I think that would be a really good idea. So thanks. Any questions you have, I'd be glad to answer.
I have a question. It may be in here, but is there a requirement for hospitals to give their average or median duration of stay? And the corollary question is, do hospitals, particularly smaller hospitals, get their 90% occupancy or whatever by putting long-term care patients in there and leaving them there for weeks or months?
Answer to the second question, I'm not sure, but I don't think they do. I don't see how you could get away with that. The first question was on what kind of specific data do they collect, and it's real interesting that as I've traveled to different meetings across the country and talked to different people and the health departments, many health departments have Centers for Health Statistics, and they collect all this data. And many states, I think at least 33 or 34 have mandatory reporting requirements for hospitals. And I talked to the people in these different departments, and I asked them, I said, well, we have a real hard time getting data in Alaska. Quite frankly, some of the hospitals don't want to give some of the data. And in the other states, they said, well, that's not a problem for us. It's required. We have Centers for Health Statistics that collect the data. And the data is a secondary issue. The real issue is policy and standards and those sorts of things.
So why not a suggestion here for mandatory reporting of non-proprietary information? Did you consider that, Scott, in pulling this together?
I think that would be appropriate as part of four.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And in fact, in SB 84, there is some language to that effect already.
There is some language in SB
14.
Yeah, under Section 14.
Can it be characterized as mandatory reporting from the hospitals? I mean, number four here says require the department to collect. We could also make it mandatory reporting to the department.
SB 84 reads the department shall require all health care facilities operating in the state to periodically file reports required by the department by regulation. I think.
Okay, so if that becomes law, this is no longer an issue. You get what you want,
there's,
right?
There's another issue here, though. That particular part of the bill, I would suspect, will only relate to information required for the CO, the certificate of need standards.
Right.
It may be that we want to talk at some point we have in the past about collecting the other kinds of mandatorily collecting the other kinds of data that any kind of authority would need for global budgeting or rate setting.
So that'd be contained in the legislation that creates the authority. So that's, I mean, that's a related issue. But
yeah.
A data collection.
This is more going to relate to information required.
Okay. And is that strong enough language for you to get what you need to make a good CON decision?
Well, we believe it is.
Okay. So we just got to keep that in mind for the authority having that data collection mandatory reporting component. Go ahead, Larry.
Excuse me, as I was saying, as Jane and I were talking about the other day, there's no provision here for penalties if facilities don't put that in. So I don't know if that's a necessary item or I don't
know.
They
don't get their certificate of need.
Yeah, well, they don't get their certificate of need.
I think one issue about collection of data is that if you get information from a facility and you don't have anything to compare it to, it's not worth as much as it would be otherwise. And I guess I'm unclear as to whether or not this would allow you to have the authority to establish a database.
That's where the issue of the penalty comes in, because the kinds of data that we're talking about collecting under the Sentinel Flurry record, because generally system-wide data from which you use to make policy. It's pretty much understood that if someone's doing a certificate of need application, that they will provide you with all the information you need in that particular facility because
okay.
They want to get the CON. This is relating more to the general collection of data.
What the impact would be on another facility, those
But we frankly had a hard time thinking. We thought about some about what the penalty possibly could be, and there really is no common. There really is no common monetary unit except Medicaid and possibly revenue sharing. But revenue sharing would go to Humana or some of the nursing homes or the specialty hospitals. So
there are some states that have specific reporting requirements annually through the state, and it's clearly defined by the state, and it's a requirement regardless of whether you're profit, nonprofit, or what your status is. And I think that's appropriate. I think that's the only way we can get the kind of information we need.
Okay, let's say that the House Finance Committee has SB 84, and let's say that committee had drafted up a new committee substitute that incorporated the language that's been developed here in 1 through 5. Scott, Jay, Larry, would that, would the CON bill be in the shape that you think it ought to be? I mean, and then we can have the debate with all the other interests in the state.
I would say that if you incorporate all the items 1 through 5 that are outlined in Scott's here, I'd say that would be a very strong certificate of need bill and would accomplish everything that we would think would need to be required.
The question, though, is what is that policy-making body? Currently, there is no such body in position to rule on what the standards
are. See, we used to have the Statewide Health Coordinating Council back in the late 70s and early 80s, and they basically took on this function. They helped develop the state health plan and set whatever standards we had in the old state health plan. Well, Scott said some of those standards were fairly weak, or guidelines. Yeah.
Okay, Roberly and then Jay.
I read SB 84, and I can't remember it addressing the issue that we've discussed here previously, and that is having an approved CON prior to going to the legislature.
That is
request funds.
That is an SB 67. That's a component of the capital grants funding bill. SB 67. All facilities must have a certificate of need in place before they can apply for a grant.
And that's the next item we're going to get to. Jay, and then Rod.
My only concern about the suggestions here, which I think go a long way to strengthen the CON program, and my deputy commissioner hat. I don't know. We haven't done any kind of on what this would cost. There would be a one-time cost associated with setting standards initially. Whether that be done, and I assume we'd do that through some kind of a contract. But you'd also have to have some cost in getting folks together and working on a policy group. And then there may be some ongoing costs related to data collection, because we don't have anyone doing that now. I can't say what the administration's position would be on a bill that had those additional costs in it. I don't know. We haven't talked to them.
Well, we appreciate the cautionary note. This group will be making a recommendation, and the Finance Committee can decide whether they want to come up with a committee substitute, and we'll see, take it through the process. Rod?
It may be implicit in 84. I don't have that in my head right now or in this, but I would like to have it explicit that an applicant show the decision maker or whatever, that he or she and the people he or she represents and the community has systematically considered the alternatives. I think there's too much stereotypic thinking about let's have a hospital, let's have a nursing home. And we've talked about this some in previous sessions, particularly for smaller communities. What do they really need? What does Valdez really need? Or Wrangell, or even smaller places, Craig? They need something where acute, serious illness and injury can be stabilized prior to transportation. Now, that may not be a hospital. Maybe it's going to be something that's flat because most seriously ill or sick people have to lie down. But it's not a hospital in the traditional sense. Another decision point is there going to be any OB done in this community or isn't there? Now, if the decision is yes, there is, then you got to have the facilities to do an emergency cesarean section and then involve anesthesia and so forth. But we really have to talk on tailor-made, or that I would say the applicant has to prove to the body that is systematically, in a system analysis kind of way, seriously considered what the community, not what it wants, but what is appropriate, and what it can support, and what it can attract manpower for, to get beyond the stereotypic adding hospital beds or nursing home beds or x-ray or lab or whatever. I think it's particularly pertinent in Alaska, where the transportation problems are so critical. Every place else, practically, you can get in the car and drive to someplace else. You can't do that necessarily here, so it takes special considerations.
Well, go ahead, Scott, and then Sister Donna.
Implicit in this thinking, I think, in the standards for acute care beds in most other places is that nobody's going to build a hospital if it's so small. Terribly inefficient. That's the impression I got. But of course, in Alaska, in many communities, the appropriate size hospital in terms of beds may be so inefficient because of its small size, not able to take advantage of any economies of scale, and having to carry such a large proportion of empty beds, such a large part of the year, that the policy question. What size of a facility does a hospital no longer, is it no longer a hospital? Is a 20-bed facility a hospital? Is a 10-bed facility a hospital? Is a 5-bed facility a hospital? I think that's a policy question. And if a policy choice decision is that under 10 beds, it's not a hospital, then that community would have to look at some alternative.
So if it's less than 10, it doesn't even have to go to CON because it's not a hospital?
Well, it doesn't go to CON. It can't go to CON for a hospital because the CON standard would say if
demand. Well, I want the language to reflect not the word hospital, but facility. Facility. You know, it might not be a hospital at all. It has to be a holding place or something. But...
Okay.
Again, just picking up on Rod's comments. I don't know if we're to the point of recommending specifics on C of N, but I would like us again to consider the fact that all providers of health care need to go through this process. Pioneer Homes, physicians' offices, if they put in this kind of equipment, this kind of service, so that we're all living by the same rules.
Yeah. Scott, is there a reason why you left that off? I mean, we've talked about it at numerous meetings of the task force.
The reason I left it off is because we haven't done the analysis to say 10 beds is a bare minimum or 8 beds.
Okay.
That's a decision that can't be made until one compares the cost of a 10-bed hospital.
Okay, that's Rod's issue. The question of all-inclusive
facilities. As I understand it,
no, SB 84 specifically exempts Pioneer Homes, and it specifically exempts physicians' offices. And that's, I can't speak to the issue of Pioneer Homes, but my feeling is that physician offices should be included in the certificate of need bill, and that would be another thing. At this point, physicians' offices having medical equipment like MRIs and things like that hasn't really been a serious problem in Alaska, but that isn't to say it couldn't change.
Couldn't be. Okay, well, are there, Robert Lee?
I brought this issue up with Dennis DeWitt, who's our new division director for Pioneer Benefits, and I was expecting him to be very supportive of CON for everyone, Pioneer Homes included, but to my surprise, he was not supportive. In fact, said CON just plain doesn't work. We didn't have time to complete that conversation, and I had relayed that to Senator Duncan. I think it would be very good to have some discussion with him. From a personal standpoint, I don't have a problem with having Pioneer Homes included for number of beds. But there's some language in one of these bills, and I don't remember which one. I've read them both, but anyway, that talks about renovation. maintenance kinds of things that have nothing to do with number of beds increasing or decreasing, whatever. And if tiny homes should be included, from my personal standpoint, and here again emphasizing that we need to talk to Denny DeWitt in this regard, I would not have an objection to including tiny homes for beds, but leaving us out in the renovations. We have our builders, we have to put new roofs and those kinds of things.
That's also true of hospitals.
Well, that is true, but since we're state-owned facilities already, it's a different.
Well, I was going to ask really what the administration's position would be. We've discussed the tiny home problem before, and there's been legal reasons, I guess, why we haven't done it more than anything else, right? And also excluded in 84, I think, is veterans' homes. Or maybe it's not excluded in 84. It's excluded in the veterans' homes bill somewhere. It's excluded. And I just been thinking about Dennis DeWitt, why he'd be against Pioneer Homes, or against Certificate of Need, and I didn't know the answer, but slightly suspicious. It's not anything to take back to Dennis, just for your...
No, we didn't finish the conversation.
Former job.
But
his former job may have gotten him thinking that way,
fact,
right?
It's a fact of life. They're not successful.
Huh? Yeah,
they're not successful.
Actually, I had questioned it earlier. Remember when we were given the chart and it showed all the vacancy rates?
Yeah.
You know, if it works, we shouldn't have that many vacancies, but I don't know what the answer is.
They train them when they go to work for the hospital association. See, that's what they've got to say.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, the bell rings and they say certificate of need is bad.
Yeah.
Only kidding. Doesn't think that way.
Well,
yeah.
what I think we ought to bring before us at one of these future meetings, and March 15th is our deadline, is the list that Scott has presented to us, these five things, plus number six, making certificate of need all-inclusive of all health facilities in the state, doctor's offices, pioneer homes, veterans homes, and anything else anybody can think of. And we'll be taking that as a, you know, up or down vote on that, or breaking it down into pieces to be voted on as a recommendation for March 15th. I don't know, if Mike felt comfortable, I'd make a request of him to get a blank CS prepared, that it has as much of this that he cares to put in a CS, so that we could see how the SB 84, with these
things. House Bill 70-something.
Or House Bill, whatever, whichever version of it, a blank CS, so it wouldn't be a Finance Committee CS, but just to see how it reads in the law from what is in the bills now, and then with this stuff grafted onto it, how it would look as a whole. So that the members could consider that, or we just could be comfortable with this, you know, the pros here, and recommend that that be incorporated at some later date by the appropriate committees. I think it'd speed things up if we got the drafter working on this now, and people could see if they're comfortable with the way it would look in legislation. But that really is committee's business rather than our business.
I've got a question about the including doctor's office. At what level, or what is it? Or whatnot. The office, my office that I left a few years ago, since I left, volume of patients and the number of doctors in the office is the same, but they had to add a whole room and another clerk just to do the insurance stuff. Now, would they be proposing that the office would have to go to CON to add the room and the girl?
We're talking about equipment over a certain dollar level.
It would probably be medical technology, mainly like MRIs and that sort of thing. In some states, that's a real serious problem, doctors' offices having high technology equipment and referring a lot of people to their own equipment that they own.
It's not as big a problem here. It could be.
It could be.
Why not take care of it in the law now that we're having this big battle over CNN?
Well,
CNN,
that's sort of slightly different question of referring to something else you own, but it would be a $500,000 level or something like that for purchase of office equipment.
Something
that
like
kind
that.
Of thing.
Yeah.
That's right. Maybe Harlan could clear that up for us. Harlan, we've gotten the impression from the association in the past that if we included everybody and made it a level playing field, that the biggest part of your heartburn with CON goes away, right? But if everyone's on this, I'm taking you at face value on that, and that's what I want to see happen. Do you have any comment on your current position?
Well, I think that you need to do a couple of things. Number one, I really think that you discuss for a little while whether or not the district need program has worked. I think there's some awfully good arguments to be made that the COA process does not work. And I think that needs to be debated before this group. Now, the second thing I think that needs to be debated before this group.
The bell rung.
It's a cost
let's move on to the second part of this. Go ahead quickly.
I just wanted to say that I really appreciate Roman's comments. I think it's, for me, generally a feeling that the Pioneer Home System, it looks at itself as a real integral part of the long-term care system. And I just really want to commend you for what you just said. It was really good.
Since we have a Pioneer Home in June.
Okay, we need to get through this to make our 5 o'clock here. Let's talk about Senate Bill 67. We're talking about capital grant criteria that might be grafted onto that legislation. Actually, the idea is to have something this session to judge the $70 million that's coming down the track and possibly to put into statute as permanent criteria for legislative review of capital grants for health facilities, not just hospitals, but clinics or whatever a community is asking for. So, Scott, are you going to lead us through the second part?
Yeah.
Okay. Please.
What I was asked to do was try to incorporate those criteria that passed out and discussed last time into SB 67, which is the proposal to create a healthcare facilities capital grant fund. And in doing that, I started thinking, well, what's the role of the state in funding healthcare facilities? I realize it's sort of stepping back from the immediate problem, but I wanted to be clear in my own mind what was going on. So I came up with four possible reasons why the state would be involved in funding healthcare facilities at the local level. And I've listed them here, and each one implies is sort of a different financing, funding mechanism or system. The first is that just that healthcare facilities can't get their own long-term financing, so that would imply loans to local governments or loans to hospitals with the eventual repayment of those loans. The second would be that, well, we think healthcare is a public good like education, and that people aren't, people, if given their druthers, wouldn't buy enough of it because the benefits of good health go beyond the individual. That's what we think about education. People don't get as much education buying it by themselves as society would like because there are public benefits from education, well-educated public. If we think that's the case, then we should be subsidizing healthcare expenditures. And we would do that then through some sort of categorical matching grant program where the state portion of the payment would be commensurate with the public share of the benefits, those benefits that go beyond the individual. The idea being to get people to consume more public, more healthcare. The third is, well, maybe the state government is the tax collector for local government, and then it just distributes revenues to the local level. Well, that's true then, that local government can take those revenues and spend them on whatever it wants. Well, if that's true, then that implies unrestricted grants to the local government to do anything they want with the money, and that money be allocated among districts on the basis of some need based on income or tax capacity. The fourth is that the state should be providing better access to health care for residents. This is the idea that the state should attempt to provide equal or equivalent access to health care to residents in different locations and perhaps under different situations. And if this is the rationale for public involvement in health care facilities expenditures, why is it public funds should be spent in ways that provide the most improvement in access at the least cost? And if that's your criterion, then you need to look at alternative ways of providing that access, which facilities construction is one alternative, but not certainly the only one, and it requires some sort of comparative analysis or benefit cost analysis. guess I, in looking at the legislation and what I've heard through this body and others, it seems to me that four is really what we're talking about here. It's really the role that the state is playing when it's providing money for facilities construction. And if that's true, then funding should be aimed directly at the target that is providing for equality of access, and really limited to that. And that suggests that the program really should be called the Healthcare Access Grant Program rather than Facilities Construction Program. And that the objective then of the grants would be one of equalizing access to individuals in different circumstances. And the subsidy would not be then for the entire facility, it would just be for that portion of the facility that increases the cost. But the cost is above some standard that has been determined by some policy analysis. Well, we know that small facilities are expensive both because they don't have scale economies and they have low occupancy rates. Quality of care, besides, may be that is both less costly and provides better quality. And it, as it turns out, most Alaska acute care facilities do have excess capacity using occupancy rate standards based on comparison to the national average or based on the 1984 health plan or based on some demand-based standard. And unfortunately, we don't have the detailed cost and quality information to determine whether some of these hospitals fall sort of below a minimum standard in terms of viable hospital size. But it seems that prior to funding activities to equalize access for healthcare, the most efficient delivery system for a location has to be determined using some sort of benefit cost analysis, and such an approach is suggested in the criteria for cost effective investment in acute care, which is on the next two pages, which is the two pages that I handed out last time, with some modifications based on the discussion last time, as well as some suggestions from Dr. Wilson that I received after that meeting and that she was unable to attend. So I haven't rolled these criteria into the language of the bill. Rather, my suggestion is a more radical one. The idea of the capital grants program should be rethought as a, to be rather an access grant program, if in fact that's the rationale for what the public spending on hospitals is.
So, Scott, if the thinking is that facilities should have a CON prior to approaching for state funding, then would some of this process here that you outlined be able to fit into the process of the CON? Would be sort of duplicative for these facilities to do this twice.
Right.
Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. A problem now, as I understand it, is there are several proposed facilities that have a CON in hand.
Right. This could be information used to blend into the CON, you know, the regulations and things for future construction.
I see.
We also wanted something to use this session to judge this $70 million. So it's a, you know, it can be used for two different things, or the short term and the longer term. Go ahead, Rick.
Johnny, on Scott, on the last page, three at the bottom, three, choose the least costly alternative. That may make economic sense, but practically you can't do that. You have to have some qualifier consistent with public safety or something. You just can't automatically choose the least costly and not have something to take care of. See what I'm saying? It's sort of like on bidding the lowest and best bid, or has to be some consideration other than just the dollar sign, and the consideration is public safety.
Well,
not absolute safety, but reasonable ability to stabilize serious illness or injury.
I took your advice on that in terms of eliminating all, what was alternative B, which was eliminate the facility altogether.
Yeah.
And I looked at number three, choose the least costly alternative, and I wanted to say something else along the lines that you're suggesting, but I didn't want to. Want to weaken the decision criteria, and I didn't feel like I was in a position to make that policy judgment of what's the minimum viable hospital size, which I think is the decision that needs to be.
Well, where are we on? We're on the last page.
Last line.
The last page.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Criteria.
Choose the most costly alternative.
Right. So you're arguing for some qualifying language there. And why did you completely eliminate, don't build any facility? I mean, that may be a rational choice in communities where there is decent access to, reasonable access to a larger community. I mean, that's a viable option for us not to build one of these things.
That would always be the cheapest, and therefore nobody'd ever get anything.
No, I'm not arguing
that it should be considered
against your qualifying language on the last point. I just don't think that eliminating the option of not building a facility at all of any kind in a community, I don't think that should disappear from the list.
Yeah. Well, it's still there under alternative three, which is other system configurations. But it is no longer explicit, and I was taking the lead from Dr. Wilson there, but I guess as much as anything, it was a simplification, I guess, to get interest focused on a trade-off between an acute care facility and what I call a trauma stabilization and transportation facility. And the trauma stabilization and transportation facility is not specifically defined. That's much more amorphous, I think, than the hospital definition. Of hospital.
So alternative three could say other system configurations which provide equivalent access. Okay, I guess it doesn't need to say any more than that. I mean, you can read into that. Just go to another community, drive up the road, if that's available. So, Rod, what would be your suggestion for number three? Choose the least costly alternative within a standard of reasonableness of ability to stabilize.
Choose the least costly alternative, comma, considering reasonable public safety.
Larry, what's your comment about, the legislature may use this criteria for judging capital projects, and then in the nearer to longer term consideration of any of this language or approach that Scott's developed with then certificate of need or establishment of a new fund and a program in state government called Health Access, where do you see us using this work, if any? Does it blend in any of the CON regulations, or is it just an approach to future capital facility construction fund?
My own opinion on this is that this really fits in better with future processes like the certificate of need in the future. It doesn't answer your problem of having $70 million worth of facilities looking at you in this legislation.
Well, yeah, there's not going to be any formalized structure during this session.
Right.
This is just us as individuals saying, okay, Sitka, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Unalaska, let's sit down here and talk about this list, and let's go through here. And this is a guide to how an intelligent person would approach whether, they're going to vote for an appropriation or not. So that's all a very informal process among our colleagues. So there's no way to formalize that now. But in terms of formalizing it in the future, if we care to do so, I'm just trying to figure out where it fits in to regulation, to statute, to a new capital construction. construction kind of fund for hospitals or health facilities, or I'm just looking for guidance on that point.
I think the way SB 67 now is written, and you might not agree with me, right? What that does is that ranks projects relative to one another. It doesn't show that they meet necessarily the minimum need like they would in a certificate of need program, but SB 67 is really supposed to say, at least my understanding, which hospital is in falling down or in much worse shape than the other hospital, or that sort of thing. So I don't know if I can answer your question. I think SB 67 is a good approach, as long as the state is going to continue to fund health facilities.
To the extent that a lot of the issues that Scott identified, a lot of the questions Scott asked under his implementation, number one, you know, the historical patterns and a lot of that information, that seems to be all information that you would need to satisfy the CON standards, you know, when they exist. I think that this stuff...
So that's stuff that would show up in a CON regulation. After we pass SB 84, when you guys get to do the regulations, this is the kind of stuff that would be included.
Yeah, I think we're, like I was saying, you know, I think you'd have to have some way of deciding whether or not a community was going to get a hospital or some other kind of facility. And then if you make a decision what kind of facility you're going to have, then you make a decision how big that facility should be. And I think this goes in with that, as part of that. The other question that Larry brought up, though, is interesting one in the SB 67, because one of the things SB 67 does is require the CON before you get into the process. Well, that's the threshold. So theoretically then, every facility that's in the SB 67 availability is equal because they all have a certificate of need.
Okay, the bill does that now. 67 requires the CON.
Yes,
the current form of it does.
Yes, but the CON will not do anything as far as rating projects. I mean, that's the project. SB 67 has a whole different process for rating them.
Or prioritizing,
I mean,
prioritize against each other.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Ron?
Going back to your no facility option, I think a community should be required to describe the impact if you have no facility at all. And I would suggest on the last page maybe inserting a new 2 and then renumbering 2 and 3 and say, describe or discuss the impact community of having no facility at all. Now the description would be the sky is going to fall in, it would be very histrionic and so forth, but people ought to be made to do it.
I agree that that needs to be a factor in it, but the community need and what the impacts are on the community. In the past, you know, every community wanted Pioneer Home, would like to have a Pioneer Home because they don't have to pay anything for it, right? And the same thing is true of mostly for hospitals. It's a function too of how you're going to pay for it and what the alternatives are. And as I think Johnny mentioned earlier, if communities have access to roads or access to other care, then we just can't afford because the economies and scale in Alaska to provide facilities of any kind everywhere. Because we have that problem with the Molly Hooch decision and the schools that we're trying to build. What we end up with is a bunch of substandard schools rather than a few regional schools that would provide a much better delivery of service to those people. So that, and you know, it's a little frustrating to talk about the certificate of need process, because, and I will plead ignorance to exactly how the certificate of need process works, except that it doesn't seem that it's worked so well. And so simply requiring in a piece of legislation a certificate of need before you define in explicit terms how you make sure that a certificate of need is, you have to have a certificate of need that really provides some level of scrutiny or ability to toss out something that doesn't make sense.
Well, here's our big opportunity to make certificate of need work. And Scott, if I had to make a prediction, the legislature isn't going to create a new grant fund or building program for whether we call it facilities or health access or anything else. I like your theoretical construct, the way to approach that, but we're not likely to create that. We may this session pass a bill, SB 67. It may get changed around that prioritizes, put a process for local communities to go through to figure out, you know, their needs for some kind of facility, what kind of facility is most appropriate, and a way for us to prioritize among all those demands for capital dollars and a requirement for local match and that sort of thing. That's much more likely, and I would expect to see Senate Bill 67 change somewhat and have a decent chance of passing. But the idea of a new, I mean, you heard Mike say we're not setting up any kind of fund for explicit funds. So a process or a prioritization for, you know, health facilities to compete in the capital budget with every other, you know, public demand, or so that there's some filter by the time they get there. Or if they're there in the capital budget, you know, battle, we send them back to go through the filter of this process set up in SB 67. That has some reasonable likelihood of being part of this puzzle.
Well, I guess what I was trying to do was to get the task force to think about the question of why, what's the role of state government funding local hospitals. Okay. 75% match with this legislation.
Well, in your thinking about it, is 75% the amount? You know, you were thinking about the good that having these facilities does for society, like public education. You know, people left to their own devices won't buy as much health as is good for society. Is 75% versus 25% local match the right valuation of the public good at the state and local level?
I guess I didn't. Clear enough. I raised those as four possible reasons why state government should get into the business of funding.
I
one of those individually.
Right.
I guess,
and I think
my
you
feeling
recognize.
Would be no. Health is not a good like education, except for certain public health activity vaccinations. That people by and large choose among themselves how much health care they want. Then if the state is actively involved in funding hospitals in certain areas but not others, because SB 67 has a cutoff at 200 beds, you know, so there's certain areas that aren't available to
get
funding. You know, why? It must be because the state wants to equalize the playing field somehow in terms of access. It's 75% match appropriate to that. It seems to me to be an awful lot.
These things don't equate much at all, but in this school district, you know, 70% of the operating funds in the Anchorage School District come from the state approximately. There's some federal money too, but so there's 70% roughly, and you know, in your construct, you argue that public education provides more of a societal good, and this is more, healthcare is more prone to individual choice beyond the public health functions of the healthcare system. So that would argue that less than 70% should be the state's obligation in providing or equalizing that access to care among citizens in the state.
Right.
So maybe SB 67, we need to think about, you know, the state match being significantly lower than that.
I guess
somewhat lower than 75.
The question I see is how much is the state prepared to pay to equalize access?
Right.
People in different locations in the state. The 3/4 of the cost of a hospital anywhere in the state, which is what suggested in
SB67. Yeah, and we can't do that, in my opinion, because a community may decide that they can afford to pay 3/4 of the cost of the hospital and put up the money and pay for the money, and the state picks up 75%. And 10 miles down the road, there's a full facility that's already underutilized. So you build a hospital over here. I mean, that, see, see, those types of things that the state has to be able to say, no. And maybe a certificate of need process that worked, you'd be able to do that.
Well, I've always talked about how these bills, you know, substantively and politically and legislatively are very much connected and need to be considered together.
I have a question of the word healthcare access grants really triggered from something I don't know very much about 67, but I'm wondering if an organization like the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center or other kinds of clinics who need buildings to operate out of also would qualify under this, and maybe what you're saying when you look at the alternatives here, alternative 1, 2, 3, is that your matching rates could change based on the intensity of the level of care that is being proposed. You know, the more ambulatory or primary the care, maybe the larger the matching rate. It's more than likely that they won't have a large base. But again, I'm not familiar with 67. I'm not clear whether it's a hospital and long-term care approach or is it a broader approach.
I think it's a more narrow approach, but
Scott, I believe it is.
What's the term they 67 uses? Do you know, Harlan, the term of art used in SB 67? I mean, it's does it just say hospitals or health facilities?
Is it a licensed facility?
Well, we can, we never.
I think it's acute and long-term care, meaning I think it's more narrow. Let's see. Health facilities. This has to find.
Health facility means a nursing home or facility that provides hospitalization for inpatient medical and surgical care of acute illness or injury or obstetric care, but does not include a nursing home or facility that has more than 200 beds.
More narrow.
So you might want to look at broadening it to ambulatory care centers or primary care trauma stabilization and these clinics that are trying to provide services for them.
You'd be fixing a lot of rules.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, health is not only delivered in hospital centers.
Okay, is there anything else we need to take care of today?
We want to know.
Rob?
On this stuff on Parkbury Farm, don't necessarily read this article on Target, you may if you want to, but there are a couple of tables in there that show some Alaska malpractice rates. That's the main reason. And this complex sheet, I'm going to take you through in about 5 or 6 minutes. It's an alternative dispute rep thing, so you don't necessarily have to study that. The other things are just some Alaska-specific experiences on malpractice disputes.
Good.
Can I ask him a question?
Well, Saul, we're really not taking public testimony, but if it's a quick one, go ahead.
Yeah. Where did Alzheimer's fit?
Alzheimer's care of the...
Where does it fit? I mean, you're talking about getting a handle on the pot, but let's figure out what's putting in that pot.
Yeah, it's a subset of long-term care.
But you have no standards.
No.
It's not even recognized as medical because it's primarily social. And then you wind up with two medical problems, the caregiver.
Good point. Okay, we're going to be back here at 10 tomorrow morning sharp. See you then.
Sharp.
Ready to go.
Yeah,
right.
You too.
Yeah, I'm going to watch you with the piece. No.
We're going to start out with a presentation by Dr. Wilson. I think we all still have our paper from yesterday to be distributed. We'll go through that and then have a discussion. Then I believe we're going to invite Dr. Thorne back to the table on behalf of Senator Petula for a run-through of House or Senate Bill 73 and 74. Didn't get quite the chance to do that yesterday, but now that she's now that we know that she's on staff for Senator Petula, she was sick for a while and wasn't able to attend the meeting. This is all things that we found out yesterday, and Senator Petula is anxious to have someone make a presentation to us about his legislation. So we're happy to accommodate that, and we'll do so after we've gone through our discussion of malpractice. With that, Dr. Wilson.
Okay. I'll go along, and at 10:45, we're going to hear from
Larry.
I don't know what else he finished in or your questions, if then in the lap over after that. Larry has provided us with a sort of a background, what's going on in malpractice across other states, and updated a little bit. And I thought I would tell you the scene historically in Alaska to some extent, because I've been involved in a good bit of it. If I misspeak about the law, they please jump in and correct me. I think you're the only attorney here. If there are other corrections as I go on.
I consider myself a recovering attorney.
Somehow I envision
this audience
would be full of attorneys on one side and doctors on the other. Strangely quiet.
We have an attorney in the audience, too. Please speak up if I say something incorrect about the law. I started private practice to a limited extent in Cincinnati in the early 50s, and the premium for malpractice coverage was $15 a year. All doctors had it in the Midwest, practically all doctors, through the Medical Indemnity Company of Indiana. I think they were in Terre Haute. I guess they never lost a case. There were very few cases, so it's $15 a year. By the time I got up here in 58, I recall that I was still paying about $165 a year or something, and I was getting that through a national organization of internists called the American College of Physicians, and the psychiatrists got theirs through their national organization, and the OBGYN and so forth. All of that's gone away. Since, but it was relatively cheap. But there was a crisis of sorts in the middle 60s in Alaska in malpractice, and at least alarm. And we went down to Juneau and harangued this and that, and made sure that the principle of res ipsa loquitur did not apply in Alaska to malpractice cases. That is, the thing doesn't speak for itself. You had to have an expert testimony in order to win a malpractice case, and that's true to this day. I recall the late John Savage, a trial attorney, being in on that. But still, and the first medical malpractice case to go to trial occurred about that time, Patrick versus Sedgwick. Dr. Sedgwick was a prominent surgeon in Anchorage, and he may have cut the recurrent laryngeal nerve in doing a thyroidectomy, and the person ended up with a hoarse voice, and he lost that, and I think it was $50,000 or something. It seemed astronomical to the medical profession at that time. But the premiums didn't go up for malpractice insurance too much, because the late 60s was a time of booming stock market. I remember I made a good bit of money, enough to send my kids to college, because it wasn't that I was smart, but the stock market was just so good at that time. But by the early 70s, across the country, both the frequency and the severity of medical malpractice cases began to surge. The severity meaning the average dollar award on those cases that got an award. And I think it's a sort of a secular mystery why this happened. I don't think sociologists or anybody has quite figured out why, about this time in the history of the nation, people started to sue more, juries started to award more. It wasn't the attorney's fault, or, you know, they just followed the trends, and it's very complex why that happened. But the insurance companies had not been charging nearly enough in the way of premiums in the early 70s. So by the mid-70s, the stock market wasn't that good. They weren't making that much on their investment. So a lot of them failed or pulled out. So in the mid-70s, across the country, and certainly in Alaska, here too, there was another crisis, this time a real crisis, because there simply wasn't any coverage. The specialty society, as I mentioned, stopped writing. So most of the doctors in Alaska were bare. We just didn't have insurance. And so Governor Hammond called a commission on medical malpractice in 1975, headed by his secretary's Commissioner of Commerce, Tony Motley, who later was Reagan's ambassador to Brazil, and his sidekick, who was in Dave's job, Richard Block, the director of insurance, who really ran the show pretty much, though Tony came to play of it. And we labored in him, and I think we were 17 strong, too, like this commission, this task force, three doctors on it, including me and Bob Whaley and Bill Kinn from Fairbanks. And we came up with some minor tort law changes of redefining the standard of care and the locality and a few things, worthwhile words, doing away with ad damnum. That means that in a suit, in filing a suit, you can't name an amount that you want, $1 million or $10 million. And I remember a trial attorney jocularly telling me such a figure is very alarming to a doctor. He sued for $1 million, and sort of the implication in the public of the doctor looks at it this way, or the hospital, somebody will look at that casually and say, gee, gosh, he really must have screwed up. So they did away with ad damnum. A trial lawyer told me at one time, said, oh, don't pay any attention to that. We just let the girls at the front desk fill that in before they go to court. So that was small comfort. Took 2 or 3 years before the judges and the attorneys learned that they weren't supposed to put that number in. So even in the 1980 or so, an amount was being named, and no attorney even ever got his wrist slapped for that. But the main thing we did was create the MICA, the Medical Indemnity Company of Alaska, which Dave has talked about before and we've talked about before, and that served a useful purpose for a number of years in providing medical malpractice insurance to doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, and so forth, and now it's been sold off. But it filled a function, and pretty soon another company came along, a doctor company in California, a so-called bedpan company. They're called sometimes Medical Indemnity Exchange of California, which to this day insures a lot of doctors. It's been very successful because they've set the premiums correct and high, and they've been funded well, and their defense has been well. The other thing that was done was set up a panel system whereby almost every lawsuit, medical malpractice lawsuit that is filed in Alaska has to go through a three-provider, usually three-doctor panel for a review. Now, if the question is only if the doctor or dentist, say, admits fault and it's just an argument about money or something like that, it doesn't go to the panel. But by and large, almost all of them are supposed to go, and indeed have gone to these three-person panels, and usually they've been doctors, to review the case, not to answer the legal question of whether there was medical malpractice, but to describe the biology of the case and the intervention on the part of man in the natural course of the disease. I can tell you much more about the panels if you're interested later, but I'll leave that. The panel system is still working, and there's no similar panel system anywhere in the country. There are other panel systems, but usually there's a lawyer and a doctor and a public person on it or something like that. Our panels, the opinion is admissible in court. The panelists can be deposed later, can be hauled into court to explain their position. It's hard to tell in my own mind, and I've thought and studied a lot about this, whether they've been useful or not useful, but they are a fact of life in medical practice in Alaska. Nobody likes them. The defense lawyers don't like them, but the plaintiff's lawyers don't like it. The doctors do it, but they do it reluctantly. There must be something worthwhile if everybody likes it. In 1976 to 77, there was sort of a hiatus. Doctors had been there, the companies were coming back, there were almost no lawsuits for a while there because people were confused. They didn't know about how the panel system was going to work. Long about that time, I was sued, and I didn't have insurance. a young guy from California had a motorcycle accident, crushed his chest, and had a severe concussion. And believe me, I believe that I and a neurosurgeon saved this kid's life. Well, he recovered. He woke up after about 10 days and went to a nursing home, Glenmore, for a month and recovered, and then went back to California. And lo and behold, he sued me and the Dr. Crawford at the nursing home, not the neurosurgeon for some reason, for allegedly missing a wrist bone fracture. Well, you can't diagnose clinically a wrist bone fracture in a comatose person, and it's certainly incorrect to x-ray every bone in the body on a comatose person, et cetera, et cetera. It was kind of nice in a way because I didn't have insurance. I didn't have to deal with an insurance company and their panoply of lawyers telling me do this or that. I went to my own lawyer, Ron Vinker, who doesn't do this kind of work anyway, and he said, Rod, don't worry about it. And lo and behold, after about a year, he got the suit dismissed with prejudice, and it only cost me $1,500 in money. That wasn't very much money to lose, but it cost me a lot and still does in terms of outrage, disillusionment. Did I go to school for 25 years to have this happen to me? Cost my family and grumpiness and anxiety, and you know, you can tell by the tone of my voice that I'm still outraged about it. But a lot of doctors are there, and they're still there. It's hard to find out how many doctors don't have insurance now. Maybe it's not 30%. They're not going to tell you. They don't want that known. But it's a problem, and that's not fair to the public to be uninsured, because people should have the right to recovery. So cases started to pick up again in the 80s. The average national award, jury award in 1980 was $405,000. By 1984, the average jury award was $955,000. And by 1985, in Alaska, we had 179 cases. And this is this handout that shows the cases by year. I studied it at that time. 85 was complete, but I have later information. 85, we had 55 cases. Now, these are lawsuits. These are not claims, but actual cases that were filed in court. 86, 31 cases, 87, 37, 88, 29. And we're now 401 cases in 92. Since 1975, when the part law and the panel and so forth, that's when we began counting it. And you may have some questions about the type of cases and so forth, which are included in there. It includes a lot of dental cases, some chiropractic and optometrist and everything. We've done some other study. It's commonly thought, and it's true to a certain extent, that the medical malpractice system weeds out bad doctors and runs them off, and that's true to a certain extent. There was a bad doctor in Fairbanks that had two or three lawsuits, and that certainly helped to get him on his way. There was a bad surgeon in Kodiak who had several cases. Knowledge of medicine and surgery was small, and he had two or three garish medical lawsuit, so he quit medicine and went into law, and now he's back as a trial attorney suing the doctors. I think he's still there. I'll tell you his name privately later if you want to know. But good doctors, and there was a bad dentist here. I don't think he really knew how to do root canals, and he had six or seven cases, mostly involving root canals. Finally got him to stop. So the system helped get rid of those guys. But on the other hand, the best and the brightest are sued here. Dr. Hale, Dr. Scholl, Dr. Beal. There isn't any better ENT guy around than Beal. Dr. Castella, the outstanding neurologist, he's been sued. Dr. And on the peninsula, Dr. Sangster, Dr. Enabo have been sued. Ketchikan, Dave Johnson, Dr. Shields, and Juno, Dr. Palmer, Dr. Rice, you know, we all get our turn, not all of us, but it's not just the poor doctors, it's the doctors who do high-risk things. In the 80s, late 80s, there have been other efforts to get more Tartlar changed through the Citizens Coalition for Tartlar Reform. Dr. Dave McGuire headed up a lot of that. I guess they call themselves now the Alaskans for Liability Reform. They're still trying to get major Tartlar law changes, mainly a cap on awards and things like restricting contingency fees. And they get usually Senate Republicans to put a bill in, Jan Fakes and others, and they come a cropper in the judiciary committees in both houses. Gruenberg and Donnelly see to it that they just don't get too far. And I'm not criticizing them for it, but it is a fact that trial lawyers contribute heavily to their political campaigns, as well as that of Parnell and others. So since the mid-70s, there hasn't been much tort law change, except for an initiative that this Coalition for Tort Reform got going, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago. And it did change the joint and several liability principle. Under joint and several liability, correct me if I don't have this correctly, any one of the parties is responsible for the whole thing if the others can't pay. And it got changed so that each negligent defendant was responsible only for his or her portion of the loss, or if it was less than half, no more than twice, or something like that. So that was, from the standpoint of the providers, was worthwhile. And I believe they put a cap of $500,000 on non-economic losses, which is, in my opinion, far too high still. That was done by initiative, not through the
doctor.
Dr. Wilson,
there was also tort reform legislation that passed the legislature in 1986, which was, in fact, a lot further in terms of the tort reform than most of the United States, the other states, went at that time.
Yeah,
and the other thing that I have to say is, and this is just a personal bias, because in 86, I was chairman of the Labor and Commerce Committee that worked on the legislation, and we had extensive hearings, and I'll bet that that committee knew the arguments better than the rest of the legislature. After that battle, because we hadn't gone far enough in some people's eyes, there was a bunch of doctors who were targeting me as one of the people who stood in the way of tort reform. During the next campaign, it was a big issue in my campaign, and I have received a lot of money from trial lawyers. Also, I've also received some money from doctors. But I hate to point to money in campaigns. While I think that it can be a problem, I think it's pointed to far too often, and suggestion is made that candidates base their decisions on how much money they get, and I don't think that that's the case for most legislators. I think that there's a lot of deliberation about the issues, and in some cases, maybe they know the issues better than some of their colleagues. So I just
I shouldn't have even intimated in any sense that that's true, and I have a lot of respect for Max Bloomberg and Dave Donahue. I know they call things as they see them. I sort of dropped out of this scene in the mid-80s and missed that, but you're right. The collateral source rule was changed then. Said that the cloud, if you've got medical insurance, is paying for your medical costs anyway, and you're claiming all those medical costs, that's not discoverable by the jury. You can't present it to the jury, but it comes to light in the final settlement as an offset and periodic payments. Award is over $100,000 that either side can insist that it be done later, and that can be annuitized. Those were useful.
And in that 86 debate,